You're listening to Groundwire, community news from coast to coast to coast.
How do you like global warming?
How do I like global warming? Well.
So more children will be put into foster care or into adoption, and it's going to be like another 60 scoops, so we're very concerned about that.
Welcome to the August 28th edition of Groundwire, brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association. We are your hosts, Tom McNeil
and Rachel Chopin
from CKUT in Montreal on traditional Mohawk territory.
Groundwire is grassroots news from people on the ground, coast to coast to coast. On this episode, we will bring you features on the conservative tough on crime agenda, on Aboriginal children in Canada's foster care system, and on Calgary's new poet laureate position. In our community radio reports, we will also hear about the NCRA Disabilities Handbook and from CGSF on their kids' camp. But first, here are this episode headlines.
On August 16th, Aboriginal people in Grassy Narrows celebrated the decision of Ontario Superior Court Judge Marianne Sanderson, which ruled that clear-cutting on the territory was a violation of their rights under Treaty 3. Members of the Grassy Narrows Reserve began blockading logging roads in the community in 2002 in order to prevent the destruction of boreal forests on their land, which they depend on for their livelihood. It would become the longest Indigenous-led blockade in Canadian history. In June 2008, Montreal-based logging company Abitibi Bowater announced it would no longer pursue its clear-cutting in the forest around Grassy Narrows, known as the Whiskey Jack Forest. However, the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources was still considering allowing other companies to continue logging on Treaty 3 territory. The most recent decision from the Ontario Superior Court rules that the province doesn't have the power to interfere with the band's treaty rights, which are a federal issue. Grassy Narrows activist Joseph Forbister has hailed the decision as a, quote, victory for our people. For Groundwire, this is Aaron Lakoff reporting from CKUT Radio in Montreal.
Canadian politics received a shocking blow earlier this week when it was announced that NDP leader Jack Layton had passed away after his second battle with cancer. Layton passed peacefully at his home, surrounded by family and friends. We spoke to Grand Council Chief Patrick Madabi of the Anishinaabek Nation near North Bay, Ontario, about Layton's passing.
And he always took the time to listen. And, you know, I remember one time I was meeting with the Northern NDP caucus, and he came along and sat in on the discussion. And, you know, as a busy man, you know, he didn't have to do that, but he made the time. And that just was his character, you know, that he made the time to listen to people.
Layton had announced on July 25th that he was stepping down temporarily as the leader of the NDP in order to focus on his new battle with cancer. At the time, he had promised to be back when Parliament resumed in September. We asked Chief Madabi what he would remember most about the charismatic leader.
Well, his smile. You know, Jack would always, you know, as soon as he saw you, you know, he'd have his hand out and he'd have the biggest smile on his face. And and again, you know, his caring. You know, that to me, you know, he epitomizes, I think, what, you know, we want politicians to be, is caring people that, you know, feel they can make change. And I think that's the impression that he left with me.
Jack Layton was 61. For Groundwire from CHRW Radio in London, Ontario, I'm Chris VandenBrekel.
The federal government announced in mid-August that it is investing $51 million into a new convention center in downtown Halifax, matching investments of similar amounts from the municipal and provincial governments. Despite claims by the Downtown Halifax Business Commission that the convention center will have, quote, tangible benefits to the Halifax business economy, end quote, many residents have been opposing the convention center since the proposal was made public. Activists and community members have called into question the sustainability of the project as well as the priorities of the various levels of government. Held in the downtown Halifax core at the Khyber Arts Center, the organizers asked 50 artists, activists, and community members how they would spend the equivalent funds that the government proposes for the convention center. Groundwire spoke with organizer Catherine Abreu.
It is kind of a classic example of the short-sighted supposed silver bullet plans that HRM makes for the city. And it's a misdirection of limited resources into a single structure that will ultimately be privately owned. Caledonians want to see money being directed towards sustainable transportation infrastructure. They want better housing options. They want better property tax systems so that small businesses and local businesses can thrive in our community.
For Groundwire, this is David Parker at CKDU in Halifax.
Last Friday, Montrealers made their voices heard about Canada's largest oil company, Suncor's working relationship with the Syrian regime. The Collective for Syria in Montreal, a group working to support the popular uprising for freedom and justice in Syria, and tens of people bussed from downtown to the Suncor refinery in Montreal East End. Their position? For Suncor to immediately end its collaboration with the brutal Syrian regime. Asked about their role in the Syrian crackdown, Suncor, the Petro-Canada owner, said, "We are actually not connected to the Assad regime in any way. We operate with a partner in Syria, the General Petroleum Corporation, which is a state corporation." Meanwhile, international pressure is mounting against Bashar al-Assad regime while he continues to try to crush a six-month uprising. The US banned Syrian petroleum imports, and the European Union has just announced the same decision. Since the beginning of the government protests in mid-March, over 2,000 people have been killed, including many children. Here, Rami Nakash, a social justice activist for Tadaman, a Montreal-based collective which works in solidarity with struggles for self-determination, equality, and justice in the Middle East and in diaspora communities in Montreal and beyond. He's speaking at Friday demonstration in front of Suncor.
We're protesting their partnership with the Syrian regime. They have a partnership 50-50 with the state in Syria. The state is controlled by one party that's now committing crimes against humanity.
That's it for this episode's headlines here on Groundwire, community news from coast to coast to coast. Before we go to our features, we'll take a short music break. Here is local artist Bourguet and Parier with their song Que viva el Havan.
Ay Dios mío, que viva Montreal. La montaña, belleza natural. Del oeste hasta el este. Barrio sur y los barrios del norte. Mi amigo el DJ Poirier. El talento bruto que se mueve. La escena independiente. Bajo el sol o bajo la nieve. Dios mío, que viva Montreal. Yahvé y Allah Akbar. Satanás y mismo Jehová. Kalimá, Krishna o Buda. Los ateos les vale rezar. Cada noche a salir pa'l bar. Por el plato, por el Mailand. Con el Carnival Sound System. Aquí viene la nueva era. Pa' que baile la tierra entera. De Montreal universal. Sobre la nieve se pone la sal. Dame chile pa' quemar el invierno. Tu cuerpito pa' estar calientito. Luego llegará abril. Y las terrazas volverán a abrir. Las mujeres a sonreír. Y los deseos a derritirse. Los ombligos a mostrar el piercing. Estilo flyway, medio cursi. Afuera pa' gozar del sol. Mezclando juguitos, Sprite y alcohol. Marihuana es casi legal. Pinga es mi ciudad. Ay Dios mío, que viva Montreal. La montaña, belleza natural.
That was Que Viva el Heaven by Bouillat and Poirier here on Groundwire. Next up on the show, we have our features. First, we'll hear from Tashon Da Costa, Joel Chigan, Fraser McPherson, and Christina Clark from CFRC in Kingston on the Conservatives' thought on crime agenda.
Recently, Canada has been receiving a wealth of attention for its proposed tough-on-crime legislation. Stephen Harper's Conservative government promised to pass an omnibus package of 11 bills designed to strengthen law and order in Canada within the first 100 days of Parliament. This legislation is paired with anti-refugee legislation aimed at cracking down on what the Conservative government and mainstream Canadian media deem to be illegitimate refugee claimants. Radio journalists Tashon Da Costa and Josie Gwynn spoke with No One Is Illegal Vancouver's Harsha Walia about the Human Smuggling Act, formerly Bill C-49, reaching her by phone in Vancouver.
Review right now. Refugees who are detained get a review after 24, 48 hours, weekly, monthly. Now they will not have the right to review for 1 year. And this is based on the Australian model of mandatory detention, which has been condemned worldwide. And in particular, the smuggling discourse is really, really problematic because, you know, if we don't question it, it's easy to say, oh, well, smuggling is organized crime. Of course, we have to crack down. But there's two things with that. One is that the bill in particular criminalizes migrants. It doesn't criminalize those who have the so-called smugglers. It criminalizes the migrants themselves, including women and children, as we've seen with MV Sunsea. And the second part of it is that even the smugglers themselves, not all of them are part of some big organized crime syndicate, right? Like, a lot of times, smugglers, for example, on the U.S.-Mexico border, are family members, like the coyotes on the U.S.-Mexico border. Many of them are women at the U.S.-Mexico border, for example, who are finding ways to bring in their family members because border controls are increasingly repressive. So smuggling is the very real symptom and the very real human response to increased repressive border control.
The human smuggling bill has relied heavily on the media fervor generated around the arrival of the MV Sunsea in August of 2010. Upon its arrival, the 192 Tamil refugees on board were detained at three separate detention centers in British Columbia. Harsha Walia talks about the links between these detentions and the Conservative government's tough-on-crime and prison expansion agendas.
The detention of migrants very much links into the expansion of prisons. So, you know, the Conservatives have to justify this growing and expanded prison budget that they're pushing, which is part of their broader, you know, law and order kind of framework, which the Conservatives are notorious for. And, you know, as we know, prisons are also increasingly privatized, similar to the U.S. model, where people are making money off human misery and human incarceration. And in Canada right now, one in four migrants, 25% of pretrial centers, are actually made up of a migrant population. So that's something people don't know, but a vast number of prisoners right now in Canada are migrants that are being held for detention, particularly in pretrial centers. And, you know, with the expansion of prisons, we're going to see more and more migrants that need to fill up these prisons. They have to justify why these prisons are being built. And particularly in light of lowering of crime rates, migrants become an easy community to scapegoat alongside others, Indigenous people, poor people, sex workers, trans folks. All of these communities become the target for prison expansion.
Prison expansion is a cornerstone of the Conservative government's proposed omnibus tough on crime bill. One piece of legislation that has come under fire already is a bill which proposes to expand both the numbers of crime for which young offenders may be incarcerated and to increase the length of terms repeat young offenders serve. Radio journalists Deshaun DaCosta, Joel Seguin, and Rafael Rodriguez spoke with Seguin Akinsanya, executive director of Bright Future Alliance in Toronto and provincial advocate for youth justice, about the bill's implications.
I guess they're just trying to move more towards the American system because the American system is based on income based by incarceration. So instead of the government paying out, the government is it's not paying within its an internal system, but it's more privatization. So they're trying to bring it outside of that. So I think that's their model of making money, because it's not to say that the way I feel that is like everybody's an angel or anything like that. But I think if they were more towards social programs, I would be more positive and acceptive of that, because that's what helped change me in my past. There just needs to be a plan B. There needs to be a plan C and a plan D. When you're working with young people, they're at their critical stage, they're growing. And the environment that you put them in is who they're going to be later on. So if you're just imprisoning young people, then all you're going to see is more negative older adults. And then you're going to have a need for these bigger jails and these more beds in the penitentiary and all these jails that are being built in Toronto and the youth jails, because this is what you're building to. You're actually incubating that type of generation.
Parliament is set to resume on September 19th. This is Christina reporting for Groundwire.
Thanks to Tashan DaCosta, Joel Seguin, Fraser McPherson, and Christina Clare from CFRC in Kingston for those interviews. Next, we have a piece on Calgary's new Poet Laureate position. Here's Mark Affeld from CJSW in Calgary with that story.
I am personally delighted to introduce the Poet Laureate.
With a new Poet Laureate.
Poet Laureate position.
It's so funny. When I was Poet Laureate.
I understand that you're just finishing a term as Poet Laureate.
The Poet Laureate.
For CJSW 90.9 FM in Calgary, I'm Andy Williams. In honor of the City of Calgary's approval of a Poet Laureate position, I spoke to Roland Pemberton, professionally known as Cadence Weapon, to find out about his two-year term as Edmonton's Poet Laureate. What's the value for a city having a Poet Laureate?
Well, to me, it's not even just about poetry. It's more about just being having somebody who is a general arts ambassador, having somebody who can represent for the arts community, not just at home, but also abroad, you know? And it's also the kind of position that is very, I would say, limitless. You know, I feel like it doesn't have to be just poetry. You know, that's the big thing that I would tell whoever's going to become the poet laureate of Calgary. You know, it's an open-ended position.
So did you think of yourself as like an ambassador for hip hop when you took the position as well, because more people would be paying attention to what you did?
I mean, I really wanted to represent not just for the hip hop community, but mainly for young Edmontonians specifically, you know, because I felt like there hasn't been nearly enough representation of that culture in any Albertan media, you know, up to that point. Like with my music, that was something I tried to do. And also within poetry, I wanted to write from the perspective of a young person in Edmonton. I think, you know, I think people really related to it. I know when I would go and visit schools and things like that, and I would get the students to write poetry as well and show me things and tell me how they felt about being from Edmonton or whatever. And a lot of people, you know, they might have been much younger, but they experienced the same kind of societal hazards that I had, you know, living in Edmonton.
Do you think that's the intrinsic value of a position like a poet laureate, is that it's a way of documenting a certain location for a certain period of time?
I think so. And, you know, I was really surprised during my term. I went to the Poet Laureate Conference in Halifax. And what I noticed was that most of the other poet laureates, they would perform their poetry. And I noticed I was the only person who specifically referenced where I was from. You know, I specifically referenced landmarks or cultural aspects of where I was from in a more direct manner. Most other people just were using it as more of like a background for their own poetry, you know, no matter what it was about. But I took it very literally to talk about Edmontonian things. And maybe that says something about being from Edmonton versus being from other places.
You just heard from Cadence Weapon, Edmonton's former poet laureate. For CJSW Radio in Calgary, I'm Andy Williams. For an extended version of this interview, go to cjsw.com.
Thanks to Marc Affair from CJSW in Calgary for that piece. Next, we come back to CKUT in Montreal, where Christine Giroux-Adja reports on the growing rates of Aboriginal children being taken away from their families and being put into foster care.
Some are calling it the Millennium Scoop. Former Grand Chief of the Ontario Union of Indians, John Bocage, says more Native youth being taken away from their families and placed into foster homes and other institutions today than during the infamous 60s scoop, when thousands of Native children were forcefully removed from their families. Sponsored by the government and churches, the assimilation program put children in residential schools where they were prevented from speaking their Native languages and often beaten and abused. Bocage, who issued a report to the Ontario government in June, spoke with Grand Wire about some of his findings.
Basically, there are about 20% of the total children in care across Canada are Aboriginal children. And that compares with about 1.5% of the total population in Canada being Native. So there's a huge, huge overrepresentation of Native children in care.
According to a 2008 report by the Institute for Research on Public Policy, there were approximately 27,000 Aboriginal children in government care, three times the number of children enrolled in residential schools at their height. The report also found that in some provinces, Aboriginal children were eight times more likely to be in foster care than other Canadian children. Marie Rana is a manager in the foster care development of Batshaw Family Services, a center in Montreal which helps to place children in foster care. Rana concurs that she sees a growing phenomenon of Aboriginal children coming through their center.
As of today, we have 58 children out of 347 children in foster care. So 58 out of 347 are Aboriginals. So we're definitely seeing an increase of Aboriginal children in foster care if we compare it to maybe 4 years ago or so. And we try very hard in the foster care department to recruit foster homes that are Aboriginal.
While residential schools began shutting down in large numbers during the 1970s, the last one closed its doors in 1996. In 2008, Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper issued an official apology for Canada's residential schools.
The government now recognizes
that the consequences of the Indian residential schools policy were profoundly negative, and that this policy has had a lasting and damaging impact on Aboriginal culture, heritage, and language.
Yet the apology was widely criticized by Native communities at the time, saying that without an action plan and funding to repair the negative effects of residential schools, the apology was empty words. Today, the Bocage report casts further doubt on Harper's apology as he links the current problem of Aboriginal family separation to the legacy of residential schools. The director of the Native Women's Shelter in Montreal sees a similar problem in the province of Quebec. According to Nagouset, the province's Youth Protection Act only gives mothers who are struggling with addiction problems 1 year to get back on their feet before the government takes away their children.
It really affects the women here at the shelter because we know that if they have 10 years of trauma, chances are 1 year of therapy is not, they're not going to be able to make it with that deadline that's now imposed on them. So more children will be put into foster care or into adoption, and it's going to be like another 60 scoops, so we're very concerned about that.
One of the recommendations of the Bocage report is for more funding to be dedicated to Aboriginal children's aid services and drug prevention programs to help deter the abuse and addiction which led to the breakup of families. Another recommendation is for the government to support programs that preserve Aboriginal culture, which could in turn lead to a strengthening of identity and communities. The Ontario Ministry of Children and Youth Services says they're working toward implementing some of the recommendations from the Bocage report and have already contacted the federal government to ask for more money for Aboriginal services. However, Bocage says part of the problem is the way that federal funding works. Funding is handed out based on how many children are in care, but fails to be allocated for prevention programs. He says there are a few Native communities in Ontario which have no children in foster homes and therefore don't receive funding for prevention programs. This, he says, needs to be changed so that the problem can be solved at its root. For Groundwire, this is Christine Jayaraja for CKUT Radio with files from Aaron Lakoff.
Last up on this episode of Groundwire are our community radio reports. First, we will hear from Stéphane Bertrand from CKUT Radio in Montreal about the NCRA Disability Handbook.
Not so long ago, radio shows produced by people with disabilities were rare. Slowly, that reality is changing in campus community radio today. Now you can hear shows produced by adults with disabilities on different stations across Canada. At CKUT, The Avalanche, a current affairs show produced and hosted by people with intellectual and physical disabilities, has been on the air for almost 6 years. At CJAM in Windsor, HandyLinks, a similar news program, produces regular, high-quality programming. Yet accessibility is still a problem in radio for many. But things may continue to be looking better after the publication of the Disabilities Handbook, which will lay down some guidelines for radio stations across the country and be accordingly distributed by the National Campus Community Radio Association. I spoke to CKUT programmer and host of The Avalanche, Stéphane Bertrand, who had the idea for creating a disabilities handbook.
I was talking to Shelley Robertson from the NCRA, which she was the membership coordinator. So like that, and I talked about the book, about how we can make the book that talking about creating more disability shows. And I thought from the workshop, we will talk about how to make stations more accessible for people who are disability, like for people who are blind, to make the mixer more braille, how to put braille on mixers, or how to make it more accessible for somebody for a wheelchair. So that's how I got my idea for the handbook.
I also spoke to Stephanie Pinch, the editor of the handbook, who had this to say.
I like to think campus and community radio, because it's an alternative media, that the views as well are quite alternative and quite inclusive. But I think the specifics of it may have gotten lost. And that's really the great thing about the handbook, is that it's full of really practical, concrete ideas. So rather than talking about diversity as a general abstract construct, it's sort of brings it down to the level of, okay, this is what your radio station should look like. This is what the setup should be. You know, just talking about how high the desk should be, talking about spacing, different technologies that a radio station can invest in, and also creating a deeper sense of inclusion where people with disabilities have a forum to come forward and talk about accessibility and accommodation issues within their station and have some sort of follow-up go on there.
From August 15th to the 19th, CJSF hosted our very own annual Summer Kids Camp with this year's theme exploring daily sustainability and environmentally friendly efforts in our communities. Our young radio prodigies, aged 8 to 12, found out all about how they could be more green and also had some intriguing ideas of their own. Here's a clip of their radio journalism skills.
What is your favorite food at this pocket market?
I'd have to say at the moment it's the berries. I really love the blueberries, strawberries, raspberries.
Totally agree with that.
Yeah.
Yes, and why do you love these berries so much?
Well, I think they're freshly picked and they're very healthy, full of vitamins and nutrients.
I've had the strawberries, so juicy.
Oh, good. Yeah, juicy. Like
if
that.
If you weren't doing what you're doing, would you be inside the pocket market?
Yeah, I would be. I think it's, you mean working there?
No, I mean like, eating, you know.
Eating.
Oh,
yeah, yeah, like shopping.
Shopping for food that you will eat.
Yeah, I would be.
Well, I guess that's it. Thank you for your time.
Well, thanks for the interview.
How do you like global warming?
How do I like global warming? Well, I don't know. If it means that it's going to be warmer, I might like it, but...
Do you like gardening?
Yes. Gardening is good, especially local gardening.
Do you think it's better to grow your own food and stay sustainable rather than going to buy it elsewhere?
Yes, it's better to buy local, and it's better to grow your own if you can, even at your house or apartment. And they taste so much better.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Here last year.
Well, I'm a student at SFU and I came to the market sometimes, so I knew it was here. And I just wanted to help out a little bit because I thought it was a good cause. And I knew it was good for the environment.
Okay, bye. What's the difference between pocket markets and farmers markets?
Very good question. Have you ever been to a farmers market?
Yeah. So, are you part guinea pig by any chance?
I am part guinea pig. But it's only the part that's covered with clothes, so you can't see my little tail.
What do you think about recycling?
Recycling? I think it's good. We should all recycle.
Yeah!
Kids these days, seems like they really like radio and sustainability. You just heard a snippet from the interviews conducted by our CJSF Radio Kids Camp campers from August 2011.
That was Sarah Buchanan from CJSF in Burnaby. That does it for this edition of Groundwire, a bi-weekly non-profit national news program produced by the community for the community. Groundwire is heard on dozens of campus and community radio stations from coast to coast to coast and can be found online at groundwire.ncra.ca. I'm Tom McNeil
and Rachel Turpin
from CKUT in Montreal on traditional Mohawk territory, and we've been your hosts. Thank you for tuning in.